Have you ever been in a competition before? Perhaps you've competed on a little league team or a soccer team. You may have even competed in a piano competition. We Americans are a competitive society. We have competitions for everything from sports to table setting. You go to the county or state fair and you see awards for everything from jam making to hog raising. And every year there seems to be more competitions added to the already bulging menu. Competitions can be a thrilling, growing experience, a door to higher levels of achievement and service. Competitions, if viewed improperly, though, can be devastating, destroying self-esteem and desire for improvement and sharing. On this tape, we will talk about ways to approach competition so that every time you perform at the piano, you can walk away feeling good and having won. Ways to compete that will help you achieve a fuller, richer, more meaningful life, a life of progress and development. There was a popular television series many years ago. It was a spy, high-adventure thriller. The beginning of every show found the secret agents receiving a secret message from their boss on a tape recorder. The taped message would outline the incredible mission they were to fulfill. After the taped message was finished, the man on the tape would say, "This message and recorder will self-destruct in 30 seconds. The secret agents would then drop the recorder and run for cover. Sure enough, 30 seconds later, the recorder would self-destruct by blowing up. Frequently, we will give ourselves self-destructive messages, messages that create a no-win situation, a situation that causes us to walk away with negative feelings about ourselves. How does this relate to competition? I have been involved in every aspect of competitions. I have competed in them. I have organized them. I have prepared students for them. I have judged them. I have seen many students walk away happy with a greater sense of self-worth, and I have also seen students walk away disappointed and discouraged. The difference between the two reactions was not in how well or badly they performed. The difference in reaction is the way a student interprets his performance or the expectations he has going into a performance. Some of these expectations are self-destructive, just like the secret agent's tape recorder. Let's talk about one of these self-destructive messages and how to change it into self-building messages. The first self-destructive message we will talk about may surprise you. It can be a wolf in sheep's clothing. When you hear it, you may be tempted to say, "That's a destructive message." Here it is, the self-destructive message we're going to talk about. "I'm going to win this competition." There it is. "I'm going to win this competition." Now, there are some of you that might argue that going into a competition with the idea that we are going to win is just a good idea. Setting out with dreaming about it and having a good positive attitude about it is the way it should be. Well, a positive attitude is important, but it's suicide to make a goal concerning something you don't have any control over. Being the best doesn't guarantee that you'll win first place. For example, in a piano competition, can you control the judges? No. And yet, at a piano competition, it's the judge who decides who's going to win or not. It doesn't matter who really is the best in a piano competition. What matters is who the judge thinks is the best, or who the judge likes the best. I once had a student named Eric who competed in a competition. He played beautifully. He heard the other competitors in his division. They played well, but not as well as Eric. When the results were announced, Eric did not win the competition. He didn't even place. He was surprised and disappointed. He went up to the judge after the awards ceremony and politely expressed his opinion that he felt that he had played better than the other competitors and asked the judge why he didn't win. The judge, surprisingly, agreed with Eric. "You did play better than the other competitors," said the judge. "But I like a pianist that moves his body a lot when he plays the piano. and you didn't. So even though you played better, I gave the award to someone else. Anyone who has been around competitions, from local ones to international competitions, can tell you similar stories. I recently sent some of my students to a competition in Southern California. There were two judges. When the judges' comment sheets were returned after the festival, we had a good laugh. Almost everything the first judge praised my students for, the second judge would criticize them for. They had nearly exact opposite opinions on everything from technique to interpretation. I pointed out to my students that this was an excellent example of why it's dangerous and self-destructive to base your opinions of your playing on one competition, one festival, or even one judge. There was a lady named Emily that lived in the 1800s. She wrote poetry. One day, she got the courage to send her poetry to a magazine to be published. The magazine wrote back and told her that her poetry wasn't very good, and they would not be interested in publishing it at all. Emily was crushed. Years later, after Emily had died, people found boxes of poems left under her bed. They found them to be beautiful, had them published, and she became known as one of America's greatest poets, Emily Dickinson. Unfortunately, Emily listened to the opinion of one judge and based her concept of her work on that one opinion. The history of art, music, science, literature is full of geniuses who were severely criticized by others and kept in obscurity and poverty until they died. Now, please don't misunderstand me. Judges' comments and the criticism of others and competitions can be very helpful as we strive to refine our playing. Just remember that judges are human too. Evaluate their comments with the help of your teacher, but trust your inner voice and do what you and your teacher feel is best for your development. But never, never, never base your feelings of self-worth on what others think of you or your playing. Just by virtue of the fact that you are a human being makes you worth worlds, and that's a lot of real estate. The fact that we win or lose a competition doesn't change anything. You're still the same person, the same pianist or ball player before and after the competition. Receiving a trophy at the end of the day does not change how you played in the morning. Collecting awards can be fun and even helpful to a career or receiving scholarships, but in the end, it still doesn't matter. The number of awards on the wall doesn't change what you are inside. No one gets to heaven because they are better than anyone else, in my opinion. They get there because they're the best they can be. You can lose every piano competition, ball game, county fair you ever enter into, and still come out winning in the most important things. One merely needs to look to nature to learn that nothing, no plant, animal, or human ever stays static. Static means unchanging. Everything is either growing or decaying, getting better or getting worse, getting bigger or getting smaller. Nothing, nothing stays the same. I think everyone would agree that the road to happiness in life comes through growth and not decay, being a better person tomorrow than we are today. The type of competition we talked about in the first half of this tape is fun. No matter how serious or important the competition is, it is still only a game. The real game, the real competition, is the competition that occurs inside you, the eternal striving for perfection, to be better today than we were yesterday. This type of competition can rarely be measured by awards, plaques, or trophies. The competition against oneself is also more difficult than any other competition. You can win first place without having done your best. I tell my students that if they have won 100 trophies and didn't do their best, they've really lost. And yet, if they have won nothing, but have risen beyond their previous best efforts, they are the true winners, even though no one else in the world may know or recognize it. Getting back to our self-destructive message or goal, I'm going to win this competition, I'm sure that you can see how that goal can lead to frustration because we cannot always control the situation even if we do play better than anyone else. There is a competition, however, that you can control all the variables. A competition where you can wisely set the goal, I am going to win this competition. It is the competition against yourself. It is the most difficult of competitions, but winning at this competition will help you in every other competition that you choose to enter. There is a 12-year-old girl who lives down the road from us. When most people are born, their spinal cord is about the size of a pencil. This girl was born with a spinal cord the size of a pencil lead. Doctors worked hard, and through many operations, this girl had learned to walk and was progressing toward having a normal body and a normal life. However, an infection somehow started in her spine, and she nearly died. When she recovered, she could no longer walk. Again, she had to go through many operations after operation, and has been confined to a wheelchair ever since. This little girl has had a tremendous amount of courage, though. Even though handicapped, she has still wanted to participate in the activities other boys and girls participate in. At school, when the other children play soccer, the teacher gives her a paddle from a water raft. It is very difficult to maneuver a wheelchair on a field of grass. I'm sure you can imagine. She chases after the soccer ball alongside other classmates, rolling along in her wheelchair, paddle poised and ready to strike the ball when the opportunity arises. She isn't fast enough to be very effective on the field, but it doesn't matter. She's competing with herself and winning. This same girl wanted to sing and dance. I think you would agree that it would be pretty hard to dance in a wheelchair. She tried out for the local production of The Nutcracker. The director felt that a life of a child is more important than a flawless nutcracker and accepted her in the production. Many people had heard that Christy was in the production and wondered how she would be used. Opening night came, and the production went very smoothly. Finally, it was time for the Chinese tea dancers to dance. Out popped the first group of dancers after the music began. A boy was off stage with Christy. When it was her turn to go on, he gave her a mighty push. She went sailing across the stage with great speed. The audience was surprised and silent. From the other side, she received another mighty push. Christy went gliding across the stage. This time, the audience cheered, particularly when halfway across the stage, in her four-wheeled wheelchair, Christy leaned back and popped a wheelie. On the two back wheels of her chair, she spun circles and twisted and performed other wheelchair gymnastic feats while the other dancers danced around her. The dance ended, and she threw her arms up with a contagious smile on her face in a final pose with the other dancers. The audience applauded and cheered. Many cried. The newspaper called her performance a highlight of the show. Why do you suppose the audience greeted her with such enthusiasm? Because they felt sorry for this little girl in her wheelchair? Certainly not. It was because they were inspired by her example to overcome obstacles and win at the game that really counts in life. I think most of the people in that audience saw a little bit of themselves in that girl and were inspired by her courage. This girl may never help her soccer team to victory. She may never receive an award for best dancer, but she is winning at the most important game, the game of life. She is winning at making her best even better. I remember my first week at college. I was standing outside an elevator waiting for the doors to open and let me on. When the doors opened, I noticed a man that was older than the rest of the students in our dorm. I got on and this man said to me, I couldn't understand a word he said. The doors closed and I must admit I was a little bit frightened. I don't think I could have gotten any closer to the wall than I was. Again, he said to me, I looked at him and smiled weakly, wondering if I'd make it to my floor alive. The elevator stopped two floors before mine, and the doors opened. What relief. The man began to get off. As he walked out, he swayed back and forth and swung his arms wildly. If you got in the way of those arms, you could get smacked pretty hard. I know. I got smacked. I and the rest of the freshman boys in my dorm soon befriended this man and learned that Curtis had cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is a brain disorder where a person gradually loses control of his muscles. His intelligence or mind was perfectly normal. He was a very bright person who was majoring in accounting. He just couldn't control his muscles. How frustrating it must have been to have a bright mind locked inside a body that couldn't respond to its directions. As I said, Curtis had been at the university for several years before I got there. He wasn't able to work as fast as the rest of us. Because of his handicap, he could not hold a pencil to write with. He did have a typewriter, though, and he would take a tape recorder to class, in which he would record the lectures, then he'd bring it home and listen to them over and over again. To do his written homework, he would sit in front of a typewriter and wave his hand over the keyboard until it would eventually settle over the right key. He would then press it, and then he would search for the next key, sometimes taking more than a minute to find it, waiting for his muscles to finally settle over the right one, and then press it again. Curtis was easy to recognize on campus because he drove from class to class in a golf cart. The years rolled by, and those in my class graduated. About 9 years later, I returned to the university, and who do you suppose I saw driving his golf cart to class? There he was, still working on his degree, slowly but surely. After all those years, he had not given up. Curtis, literally, will probably die before he graduates. And if he does graduate, his chances of obtaining a high-paying job as an accountant are pretty slim. He will probably never achieve fame or wealth or distinction. But those are just games people play, with little lasting consequence. The big game, the game of one's own inner life, the game of competing against ourselves to make our best better, that game, Curtis is winning. At this point, we may be tempted to feel fortunate that we are not handicapped like Christy or Curtis, but we are all handicapped. All of us are born into this life less than whole, less than perfect. That's just the way life is. Some of us may have a handicap worse than Christy or Curtis. Perhaps it's a handicap of laziness that you're struggling with, or a handicap of selfishness, or even a handicap of shyness that keeps you from reaching outside of yourselves to know the joy of serving others. It's time to take our discussion out of the clouds and into your piano lesson. Next time you have a performance class, a recital, audition, competition, or festival, sit down and turn it into an inner competition. Like Curtis and Christy, a competition with yourself. For example, you may have trouble with your foot shaking on the damper pedal when you perform. Sit down with your teacher before the performance and outline the rules of the competition. Your teacher may ask you what you're going to improve on before this competition or recital. You may say something like, "Well, Mrs. Hall, my foot always shakes when I perform. I'm going to see if I can make it through this next performance without my foot shaking." Then really practice hard at keeping your foot still. Visualize yourself performing with a calm foot. When the time of performance arrives, if you were able to perform with a calm foot, then you've won. You have become better than your previous best. It may be that you were having trouble with rushing when you perform. Before your next performance, sit down with your teacher. Discuss ways that you can control the tempo in performance. Visualize yourself controlling the tempo in performance, and then when the time of the real performance arrives, if you were able to control the tempo, you have won. I remember when I was a young student, I had trouble with nerves when I would go to my lesson. I never played as well in my lesson as I did at home, largely due to the fact that I was so nervous during my lesson. I decided that I was going to play the game of inner competition. I was going to try to turn a weakness into a strength. I was going to learn to be more relaxed at my lessons. Do you think I was able to be more relaxed at my next lesson? No, I wasn't. It took 6 months of competing with myself before I finally won that game. It took me 6 months, but I did win it. I can't hang that award on my wall, but I have that award with me always. The person who won the ability to control his tempo and performance has his award with him. The person who competed to keep a relaxed foot during performance has his reward with him. A reward far more valuable than a trophy or blue ribbon. And remember, even in a competition with other people or another pianist, you're not really competing with that person. You're competing against yourself and using that person as a goalpost or marker to help you see how far you have come. Why do we compete anyway? Why do you perform? Why go to the bother of this inner competition? Why bother to improve one's inner life? We do it because life is a paradox. A paradox is two truths that seem to contradict each other. The definition of paradox is almost as bad as the word itself. Two truths that contradict each other. Paradox. Perhaps I can give an example. This example. It is a paradox that a pianist learns his pieces faster when he practices slowly. Two of the greatest paradoxes were taught to us by the greatest man to have ever lived. He said that if you want to be the greatest of all, then be the servant of all. He also said, if you want to find your life, then you must lose it. And here is the answer to why we strive to get better at the piano, why we strive to reach the $5 job. It is so that we can serve others better. And the paradox is that the better we get at making other people happy, the happier we become ourselves. Or, as Zig Ziglar says, you can get anything you want out of life as long as you're willing to help enough other people get what they want. Unfortunately, many of us find it too difficult to trust that if we help others find happiness, we ourselves become happy. We find it difficult to trust that to become the greatest of all, we must become the servant of all. Frequently, you see pianists and others trying to be better than everyone else, not so they can lift others, but just so they can be better than everyone else. Trying to gain recognition and praise is like trying to fill an unfillable hole. A person caught in this trap just can't find enough dirt, enough praise, enough recognition to fill it. This type of person often resorts to tearing others down to build themselves up. Learn to trust in paradoxes. That's what life is made of. Practice slow to learn fast. Become the greatest by being the servant of all. Use your piano skills to lift and build others, and there's plenty of opportunities to serve through your music. Develop all your talents so that you can become more serviceable to the world. I'm grateful to Brent Goetz, who allowed me to share with you a true story that happened to his grandfather. Listen carefully to your feelings as you hear this story. This true story takes place in the autumn of 1918. It was a year in which 14 million people died due to a sickness called the Black Plague, also called the Spanish Flu. Les Goetz begins this account of his grandfather by saying, "Winter came early that year and froze much of the sugar beet crop in the ground. My dad and brother Francis were desperately trying to get out of the frosty ground one load of beets each day, which they would plow out of the ground, cut off the tops, and toss the beets, one at a time, into the huge red beet wagon, and then haul the load off to the sugar factory. It was slow and tedious work, due to the frost and the lack of farm help, since my brother Floyd and I were in the army, and Francis, or Franz, as everyone called him, was too young for the military service. While they were thusly engaged in harvesting the family's only cash crop, and were having their evening meal one day, a phone call came through from our eldest brother, George Albert, bearing the tragic news that Kenneth, 9-year-old son of our brother Charles, had been stricken with a dread flu, and after only a few hours of violent sickness, had died on his father's lap. And would Dad please come and bring the boy home and lay him away in the family plot in the cemetery? My father cranked up his old flap-curtained Chevrolet and headed for Ogden to bring his little grandson home for burial. When he arrived at the home, he found Charles sprawled across the cold form of his dear one, the ugly brown discharge of the Black Plague oozing from his ears and nose and virtually burning up with fever. "Take my boy home," muttered the stricken young father, "and lay him away in the family lot, and come back for me tomorrow." Father brought Kenneth home, made a coffin in his carpenter shop, and then Dad went with Franz and two kind neighbors to dig the grave. So many were dying, the families had to do the grave digging themselves. A brief graveside service was all that was permitted. The folks had scarcely returned from the cemetery when the telephone rang again, and George Albert was on the line with another terrifying message. Charles had died, and two of his beautiful little girls, Vesta, 7, and Elaine, 5, were critically ill, and two babies, Reldon, 4, and Pauline, 3, had been stricken. Our good cousins were able to get a casket for Charles, and they sent him home in a railroad baggage car. Father and young Franz brought the body from the railroad station and placed it on the front porch of our old country home for an impromptu neighborhood viewing. But folks were afraid to come near the body of a Black Plague victim. Father and Francis, meanwhile, had gone with neighbors to get the grave ready and arrange a short service in which Charles Goetz was commended into the keeping of his Maker. Next day, my sturdy, unconquerable old dad was called on still another of his grim missions, this time to bring home Vesta, the smiling one with the raven hair and big blue eyes. When he arrived at the home, he found Juliet, the grief-crazed mother, kneeling at the crib of the darling little Elaine, the blue-eyed baby angel with the golden curls. Juliet was sobbing wearily and praying, "Oh, Father in heaven, not this one, please. Let me keep my baby. Do not take any more of my darlings from me." Before Father arrived home with Vesta, the dread word had come again. Elaine had gone to join her daddy, Brother Kenneth, and Sister Vesta. And so it was that Father made another heartbreaking journey to bring home and lay away a fourth member of his family, all within the week. The telephone did not ring the evening of that day they laid away Elaine, nor were there any more sad tidings of death the next morning. After breakfast, Dad said to Franz, "Well, son, we'd better get down to the field and see if we can get another load of beets out of the ground before they get frozen in any tighter. Hitch up and let's be on our way." Francis drove the four-horse outfit down the driveway, and Dad climbed aboard. As they drove along the Saratoga Road, they passed wagon after wagon load of beets being hauled to the factory and driven by neighborhood farmers. As they passed by, each driver would wave a greeting. "Hi, Uncle George." "Sure sorry, George." "Tough break, George." "You've got a lot of friends, George." On the last wagon was the town comedian, freckled-faced Jasper Rolfe. He waved a cheery greeting and called out, "That's all of them, Uncle George." My dad turned to Francis and said, "I wish it was all of ours." When they arrived at the farm gate, Francis jumped down off the big red beet wagon and opened the gate as we drove onto the field. He pulled up, stopped the team, paused a moment and scanned the field from left to right and back and forth. And lo and behold, there wasn't a sugar beet on the whole field. Then it dawned upon him what Jasper Rolfe meant when he called out, "That's all of them, Uncle George." Dad got down off the wagon, picked up a handful of the rich brown soil he loved so much, and then in his thumbless left hand, a beet top. And he looked for a moment at these symbols of his labor, as if he couldn't believe his eyes. Then Father sat down on a pile of beet tops, this man who brought four of his loved ones home for burial in the course of only 6 days, made caskets, dug graves, and even helped with the burial clothing. This amazing man who never faltered, nor flinched, nor wavered throughout all this agonizing ordeal, sat down on a pile of beet tops and sobbed like a little child. Then he arose, wiped his eyes with his big red bandana handkerchief, looked up at the sky and said, "Thanks, Father. Thanks." How do you think that great father felt when he saw that his crop had been harvested? How do you think all the neighborhood farmers felt as they passed by this man in their wagons loaded with his sugar beets? Can you imagine how Jasper Rolfe, the town comedian, must have felt as he said, "That's all of them, Uncle George," and then went on? And how each of those farmers felt carrying Uncle George's sugar beets to the factory? How they felt inside, thinking and wondering, "I wonder what he's thinking as he sees his field all harvested. I wonder what his face, I would give anything to see his face." There is great satisfaction that comes as we look on a hard-won trophy hanging on the mantelpiece or on the wall, but it doesn't even compare to the feelings that come from meaningful service to others. Learn to play that piano beautifully. Enter every competition you want and can, but never forget, the only competition that really counts is the one with yourself. Compete with yourself to get better and better so you can lift and serve through your music and your other talents, as these men did through digging sugar beets. Why do we compete? To better our best, and thereby bettering our service to others, which will bring greater happiness to ourselves. In giving, we receive. The great paradox, the reason for competition.